Okay, so last time we examined Genesis 1, 2, and 3. Genesis 1, 2, and 3. In many ways, some of the most important chapters, not the most important chapters from a foundational standpoint of the entire Bible. So without these three chapters, without knowledge of these three chapters, you really can't understand the rest of what's going on in salvation history. And we tried to unpack some of what was there, but really as you read through the rest of salvation history, you can see the themes, the ideas, the problems of sin and death and communion with God, being in a place where God dwells, God coming to dwell with man, all these same themes, image and likeness, all just keep coming up over and over and over again. All right, chapter 4. This is chapter 4 of Genesis. Now, Adam knew his wife, and she conceived. That's the biblical no. In the in Hebrew has very few loan words. And ancient languages, which typically have very few loan words, also then have a very large number of glosses for any particular one word. So as you're in reading in Hebrew or Hebrew dictionary, you'll have a word, and the Hebrew dictionary, you have a whole page of, you know, definition. Whereas in English, where, you know, I don't know what we have in English that's not borrowed. We borrow from so many different sources that we have hundreds of words for any one concept or idea. So then we have a word and then a very small number of definitions, then another word. So Hebrew, the word to know in Hebrew means to know, right? But it also can mean to recognize, to understand, and then obviously hear the concept of relations with his wife. Adam knew his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have gotten a man with the help of the Lord. Gotten, to own or purchase, to have the thing. And again, she bore his brother Abel. Now, Abel was the keeper of sheep. And Cain, a tiller of the ground, like dad. In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground, and Abel brought the firstlings of the flock and the fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering he had no regard. So Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell. And the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry, and why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is couched at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must master it. So as you read the story, it sounds like God's a bit of a Calvinist here, right? He likes one, he doesn't like the other, or he likes meat and doesn't like, he's not a vegetarian. And what's the issue? Well, the issue screams at us if we know salvation history, if we know the law. And we're Genesis, we're not looking at some sort of like a transcript of a camcorder recording of these events and things. We're looking at the telling of these stories by an author that is centuries, millennia after the events, you know, throughout all these biblical texts, right? Decades, centuries, millennia after events. So their audience is not the audience of the time or something of the actual story time, but the audience of the author. So when you look at something like this, you have to look back on a story like this with the Torah in mind. You have to know the entire Torah and come back to Genesis and look at it and read it in light of that. The author is assuming you know the rest of the Torah when he tells you these things. So what's the problem? Abel offered the firstlings of his flock, the fat portions, or as some translations said, the fattest of them. It's another way to read it in Hebrew. But Cain just offered an offering. Notice it says an offering as opposed to the first fruits. The first fruits. Right? You're supposed to have the first of the flock, the first things, and then the first fruits of the soil. Why is this? Because God likes the flavor of, you know, barbecued first things? No. What is it? God does not change. He's immutable, right? This is something that's so hard for us to grasp as human beings. He is immutable. He is immutable. So many theological errors can be avoided by just remembering this. He is immutable. He does not change. So we think that when we do something right, God smiles. When we do something bad, God frowns. Or he blesses us and he curses us. This is not the Judeo-Christian God. This is a pagan God you're talking about then. God doesn't change. Otherwise, he's not God. He's not the eternal God. He's immutable. So what's the problem here? When man is offering sacrifice, it is not intended to change God. It's intended to change man. God, man gives of what he has. Now, if man gives from of his surplus, it doesn't change him. If I have $1 million and I walk out and drop 100 in your hand as a beggar on the street, it doesn't faze me, right? If I have $1 million in my wallet. Let's say I'm a multi-billionaire and I decided to give you on the street a check for $1 million. I said, wow, you're really generous. No, it doesn't affect me. It has no, it's no different from if I gave you a dollar. When you have billions of dollars, you can't spend it fast enough. You don't even know what to do with it all. So if I give you $100, I give you a dollar, I give you a penny, or I give you $1 million, it doesn't make a difference. Multi-billionaire. So now let's look at it from another perspective. A poor man who maybe makes only $100 a month, and he gives to a beggar on the street $5 or $10. Think of the sacrifice that man is giving to help this fellow man, right? So, and this, and so what's happening is that individual is changing into the image and likeness of the divine giver, in the image and likeness of the one in whom he was created, right? And this is what the whole purpose of our life is to grow into the image and likeness of God, the great loving giver, right? And so, so what we need to do when we look at a text like this is say, how is this affecting Adam? How is it affecting Cain and Abel? What is the point of the sacrifice? If Abel gives the first things of his flock, remember this is before Costco, okay? So if you were hungry, you depended upon the food you produced. You might have crops, you might have flocks. You're a farmer, a rancher, whatever the case may be, a shepherd, you're going to depend on your sustenance day to day on what you produce with your hands. So if you're a shepherd, like Abel, and you get the first things of the flock, when does that happen? This is in the springtime. In the spring, the ewes begin to lamb. And the ewes are lambing, and to give the firstlings is to give your insurance, your security for the year, right? If you look out and you have 100 sheep, and the sheep all begin to lamb in the spring, all of a sudden one morning you will go out there and there's a few lambs out there. You look, you count, oh, there's 10 lambs now. And you know that all the other ewes are pregnant. What God asks is for the shepherd to take those first 10 lambs and sacrifice them to him. Not because God likes barbecue. He can do it all sorts of different ways. Sacrifice to the Lord in the Bible, even in the Torah, is there all sorts of whole burnt offering? Or just give it to somebody who's poor. Or sell it and turn it into cash and throw a big party. That's sacrifice. All these sacrifices in the Torah can be fulfilled by selling what you were going to offer on the altar, on the burnt offering, smoke and fire. Sell it, get some cash, buy a bunch of food, and throw a big party for your friends. Okay, so what is going on there? The point of sacrifice, or at least the act of sacrifice as we have it here, is to get the thing out of your hands, either by making it disappear in a ball of flames and smoke, or giving it away to the poor, or throw a big party. The point is to get rid of it. Because once you've gotten rid of it, you can't rely upon it. And that will help that shepherd realize that there's no possible way those 10 lambs that he thinks are his insurance for the year. Here it is coming. He may have some more coming, but he doesn't know if more are going to come. You know, you might say, well, maybe tomorrow he's going to get maybe another 5 or 10 lambs. Who knows? The Philistines could come over and wipe out the flock. The wolves could attack. Who knows what's going to happen? The lambs could all get sick. The sheep could die. He doesn't know. And so to take those 10 that he first sees and thinks, oh, wow, I'm going to be successful this year. This year is going to be good. This year I'm going to make it. This year I'll be comfortable. Take those first 10 and give them away. Chase them off in the wilderness. Get rid of them. Is to force the man to let go of what he thinks is going to save him and reach out for the hand of God. To rely upon God, who is his only real security and source of blessing and hope for the year. This is teaching the child to look to his heavenly Father and realize that only in his heavenly Father will he find hope and life for the year. And that's the point of sacrifice. Look at Cain now. Look at Cain, the opposite of Abel. What does Cain do? He offers an offering of the soil. An offering of the soil. Well, this should scream at you, there's something wrong. An offering of the soil, is this supposed to be the first fruits of the soil? Yeah, this language is paired throughout the Torah, right? So the first fruits of the soil. Why? Again, it's the same thing with the sheep. If you're an apple farmer, an almond farmer, an olive, whatever you've got, if you take the first 10% of your harvest, you raise barley, whatever it is, the first 10% of your harvest, and you take that and offer it to the Lord. Now, how is it to be offered? Again, just as I said before, you could throw that barley and wheat on an altar and it can go up in a ball of flames. That's one option in the Torah. Another option of the Torah is go to give it to the poor down the street. Another option of the Torah is to sell it and take the cash and throw a big party. The point of the act of sacrifice in the Bible is to get the thing out of your hands. Because by doing that, you then remove the possibility of trusting in the material world for your salvation and joy and fulfillment, rather than God. You remove the possibility of making the material world, the created world, the God in which you worship the creature instead of the creator, as St. Paul said. That's the purpose. That's the purpose of it. And so sacrifice, the tithe in the Bible that we see here in the story of Cain and Abel, this idea of the sacrifice, tithe being the 10%, that we find later in the Torah. This idea of giving the firstlings or the first fruits, this idea is something we'll find throughout all salvation history. Because God is always yearning. He never changes. He's immutable. God is always yearning for our growth, our fulfillment, our fruition, growing in the image and likeness for which he created us. And so he creates opportunities continuously in our lives, in Cain and Abel, throughout salvation history, and today, in your life today. Opportunities to give, to sacrifice from that which you think is your surety, that which you think will save you, which will give you hope. And in giving of that, you're able to let go and let God. You're able to let go of that life preserver that you think is going to save you from drowning and reach out to the hand that will draw you forth from the murky waters. All right, so that's the story of Cain and Abel. In chapter 4, verse 8, of course, Cain isn't interested in any education on the subject, so he kills Abel. And then notice it says that Cain went east. Look at verse 16. Then Cain went away from the presence of the Lord, and he dwelt in the land of Nod, east of Eden. East of Eden. So why does the author tell us east of Eden? Who cares whether it's east, west, or north? Because remember, the gate facing east in the garden is the place from which Adam and Eve were cast. In the book of Genesis, and in fact, all the way up through salvation history until we get to the book of Ezekiel, to enter into the presence of the Lord is to head west. To go away from the presence of the Lord is to head east. This is because Abraham went from the east to the west to come into the promised land. And then we'll find throughout Genesis that every time someone does something wrong, they have to go out of the promised land. They have to head up, head back east. They have to reverse the trip of Abraham. Okay? The tabernacle, when it's set up, is going to be set up so that the door by which the priests enter and the gate by which you enter the precinct is on the east side. So you head west. Okay? This is, again, this is a classic example of how the author of Genesis is expecting you to know Leviticus and Numbers and the Exodus. This author is not simply giving you, he's not some, you know, divine camcorder that's floating around in this early primordial period and is somehow recording this stuff for us. He's an author later on in salvation history. Some would say Moses, maybe, at least might have a hand here in this, but sometime, at least no earlier than Moses, in the actual written form of this, and possibly some of it, as we'll see later on, of later than him. The stories are probably going back to oral traditions among the tribes of Israel. There's great examples of this in the book of Genesis, where you have a section that's clearly coming from the tribe of Levi, and a section that's coming from the tribe of Judah and things like that. But eventually it all gets written down, and then we have what we have in the book of Genesis. Okay, so then, chapter 4, verse 17 and following, we hear about the generations from Cain, the generation from Adam, rather, through Cain. Seven generations through Cain from Adam, counting seven. The seventh generation in this line is incredibly wicked. The wickedness is multiplying. The translation doesn't do it justice here. Forger of instruments of bronze and iron. These are references to implements of war. Okay, these are a warring people, a violent people. Maker of instruments, musical instruments. Musical instruments was associated early on with pagan worship in the Judeo-Christian tradition. So these people are turning away from God. They're turning to polytheism. They're turning to the pagan gods, and they're warring and killing each other. It has often been said, and I love this image, that God is like the hub on a wheel, and we are the spokes. And the farther we go away from God, the farther we get from each other. And this is what's happening in the line of Cain. Cain has turned away from God, and his descendants have turned away from God. And they furthermore turn away from God until we come to the seventh generation, where we have a polytheist, a polygamist, and a murderer, Lamech. Lamech. You will sometimes hear people say, oh, in the Old Testament, polygamy, it was okay, multiple wives, Joseph Smith, all right. That's not what the Bible says. If you read Genesis carefully, you'll find that polygamy is always shown in a very bad light. Polygamy is first mentioned in the line of Cain. And it's typically paired with murder. Outside of the pagan world, you'll find polygamy sometimes among the patriarchs, but never in a good light. The author will always show you when Abraham or Jacob take another wife, problems. In fact, the ideal character in the book of Genesis is Isaac, who does not take a second wife. All right, now, Genesis chapter 4 ends with another one of those bad chapter divisions. I think I mentioned to you, chapter divisions come into the Bible around the 12th century AD. And some are in okay spots, some are off by a verse or two. This is a spot where the chapter division would probably be right around verse 24 and 25 of chapter 4. Either way, the story now turns back and looks now at Adam, verse 25. Adam knew his wife again, and she bore a son and called his name Seth. For she said, God has appointed for me another child instead of Abel. For Cain slew him. So Seth is the replacement for Abel. Remember, Abel was the righteous one who offered the right sacrifice, having his heart turned toward the Lord. Therefore, you're going to expect something similar with Seth and his line. So Seth, it says, was born a son. He called his name Enosh. At that time, men began to call on the name of Yahweh, the name of the Lord. Now, the name Yahweh is not revealed until we get to Exodus chapter 3. Exodus chapter 3, verse 14. Ehi asher ehi, I am who I am. You know this story. So here's the divine name here in all caps. Again, this is another example of how you're looking at a text, what is written by an author, much later than the actual events of the story, right? And therefore, that author is assuming of an audience that's much later in the story, the knowledge of information that's come between the story and the present time of writing. Okay, so Yahweh. So to call on the name of the Lord, this is prayer and praise of God. This is what a child does with his father, right? To call on the name. So look at the difference of the two lines. Cain, a murderer of his own brother, a righteous man. And then the descendancy all the way to the seventh generation through Cain of Adam, Lamech, the murderer and polygamist. Then we come to the contrasting line of people from Adam, the line of Abel or the line of Seth. And in the seventh generation from Seth, we find something very different. But we're getting ahead of ourselves here. Chapter 5, verse 1, it says, "This is the book of the generations of Adam. When God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. He made him the likeness of God. Male and female, he created them. And he blessed them and named them man when they were created. When Adam had lived 130 years, he became the father of a son in his own likeness after his image, and named him Seth. The days of Adam after he became the father of Seth were 800. So now we hear about a line coming from Seth, and there's two points to note. One is image and likeness. We hear that language again that we heard back in Genesis chapter 1, verse 27 through 29. God made man in his image and likeness. This means sonship. And he makes him in his own image and likeness, and then Seth as a child in his own image and likeness. What does this mean? Well, we talked about it before, right? Look in the mirror. You look like your parents, right? So we are like God, like God. We already discussed this. If you weren't there for the first study, you can go back and listen to the discussion of that. It doesn't mean in an anthropomorphic sense that God is like us, that God has hands and toes and things like the crazy ideas you find among the Mormons. But rather that we in some way image God. And what is that? Well, you can see it right there in the text. Always context tells you the meaning of a text. He gave them dominion over the rest of creation. We are unlike the rest of creation. And to have dominion over creation, something that God had over creation, means that we are like God. What is that? To have dominion means to be a rational being. A rational being. To have the ability to choose what is good. All right. So then, chapter 5 then tells us, after giving us this long line, and notice that each little paragraph that the translators give you is paragraph breaks. Verse 5, and he died. Verse 8, and he died. Verse 11, and he died. Verse 14, and he died. Verse 17, and he died. Verse 20, and he died. Death, 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 death. Why does he tell you that? The other line was dying too. But what does he want to tell you here? He's trying to emphasize something for you. And that's the story of Enoch, verse 21. Enoch lived 65 years. He became the father of Methuselah. Enoch walked with God. Another biblical image to be in accord with God's will. After the birth of Methuselah, 300 years and other sons and daughters. Thus, all the days of Enoch were 365 years. Enoch walked with God, he tells you again. And he was not, for God took him. That's how it is. Not he died, but God took him. And then after that, and he died, and he died. You're going to get a bunch of dies after that. But so he's trying to show you something. Now, the other line was dying plenty as well. Everyone's dying over there. But the author here is trying to show you something, highlighting the story of Enoch. Enoch is this incredibly righteous character, contrasting from Lamech, seventh generation from Adam through Seth, not a polygamist and a murderer, but someone who walks with God, calls upon the name of the Lord, and is so righteous in communion with him that he does not see death. Amazing. Enoch will come up in a number of other places in salvation history. The story of him appears again in Hebrews 11:5. Hebrews 11:5, and you also find the mention of him in Jude 14. Okay, and more on that another time. By the way, this is just a quick note. Often we talk about the dormition of the Mother of God, the dormition of the Theotokos, the falling asleep of the Theotokos. Falling asleep, this is in Greek, this is a euphemism for talking about death. The early Christians tell us what happened with Mary. After Jesus ascended, Mary continued among the apostles to pray with them and encourage them and remind them of what Jesus had taught her and taught them. And she was among them, along with Mary Magdalene, the other women disciples. And they had high respect for her for obvious reasons. Obviously, she's the mother of, you know, their master. But remember, Jesus is called the Christ, the Messiah, HaMashiach. And in the Old Testament, the anointed king, his mother had a special role in the kingdom. She was the one who looked out for those who were in need, interceded with them. And so they would ask her for prayers, ask for her to pray to her son. They would, of course, pray as well, but they would ask her to pray for them. And so we find very early on liturgical texts dedicated to this very concept of Mary praying for the faithful, to the Christians, praying for the Christians. All right, so the dormition or the assumption, this comes from a story, the early Christian, many versions of it, they all basically say the same thing, that Mary, at the end of her life, had a vision, was told that it was about time for her to go to see her son. So she went back to her home. She was in Jerusalem. She went home and she called all of the disciples of the Lord who were around, and she lay down on her bed. And before them all, in prayers and praise of God, she closed her eyes and fell asleep. That is, died. And then they picked her body up and carried her body to the tomb of her family, which is still marked in the Kidron Valley, in the Valley of Jehoshaphat, just up the Kidron Valley a bit. There's a tomb there. You can go there. There's a church built over the thing. Mark it. This is where the ancient Christians said Mary was buried, along with there's a bunch of other little holes where they buried other bodies. The bodies are not there, of course, anymore. But the place where she died, also a city, a beautiful ancient church built upon the spot, which has been long since crumbled, but other churches built and built and built upon it. You can go down the basins of these churches and see the originals. But the built upon her house there. So the Mary fell asleep in the Lord. She died. But then the Christian stories all say the same thing, that somehow, miraculously, shortly after her death, her body disappeared. It wasn't there in the tomb. You say, well, how would they know that? Well, they were pretty used to opening tombs. You know the story about Jesus, right? They wanted to go to the tomb to anoint his body. Today, you know, we're a bit squeamish about these things, right? Let the morgue take care of it. But in the ancient world, up until relatively recently, if someone died, they died in their, usually in their own bed in the home, and then people came. I just had a situation like this. So it was a kind of old world style. It was an Arab family. The guy was dying. I went and I anointed him. They called me. I came and anointed him. And then I had to go do something. I came back a couple hours later, and there were hundreds of people all over the front lawn and in the house. So they called all their friends and relatives. The guy had passed away after I left. So I went in there, and they said, he's gone. He's passed on. Okay. So I went in and we did the final prayers with him, and but his body stayed there. And as the family gathered, every family member and friend wanted to come into the house, go into his room, and see him on his deathbed. And they would look at him, and they would pray and talk to him and kiss him. And then that was their final farewell. And this is how they did it in the ancient world. Then they would take the body, because there's no embalming except, you know, in Egypt. And they would take the body within a couple of days, so usually the very same day if they could. If the guy died in the morning, he'd be buried by sunset. If the guy died in the evening, they'd bury him the next morning at sunrise. So the body doesn't decay and start to smell. And so then they would go dig a hole. The family members would dig the hole themselves, usually in a, you know, part of the property they own, dig a hole, they put the body in it, family and friends were gathered around, they throw the dirt on top, bury him, say some prayers, and go home, right? So this is what they did with the Theotokos. They put her in the ground, they put her in this niche, this little hole in the cave. And then they went back and found that the tomb was empty. The little cave was empty. Probably went back to anoint the body for the next day or something, or third day. And then, but all they found was a beautiful fragrance of flowers. And so today, of course, that's the ancient tradition. It goes back to ancient times today. You'll find on the Feast of the Dormition, or the Assumption, whatever you want to call it, of the Virgin Mary, the church is usually filled with flowers and rose fragrance and all that to remind people of this ancient story. Well, that story of the Assumption of the Virgin Mary, though extremely ancient, okay, going back to before we even have a New Testament in a canonical state, by the way, people will say, well, where in the Bible do you see this stuff? And where, well, sola scriptura is a Protestant invention. We'll talk about that in another Bible study. But the concept of assumption of an individual is throughout salvation history. Enoch, right here at the beginning of the story. Enoch walked with God. You say, wow, he must have been pretty great. Yeah, probably was. Think of the human being through whom God chose to become man. Okay? Think that one would outrank Enoch a bit, right? Think of the assumption of Moses later on. We mentioned in Deuteronomy 34, it's alluded to there. They don't know where his body is buried, but then it's referred to again in Jude 9, right? They wrestle over the body of Moses. He died, and then the body was taken. And the same thing with Elijah. Elijah's like Enoch. He's taken before he dies. Think of the righteous ones that came out of the tombs after the resurrection of Jesus in Matthew's gospel and were seen all over Jerusalem. What happened to those guys? They're not wandering around with Paul in Acts or in the Pauline epistles. I'd like to have had Isaiah or Jeremiah at Acts 15 at the council, but handy. So, but they were there. What happened to them? Well, I mean, who knows? But they didn't crawl back in their tombs, I'll tell you that. So the concept of assumption, bodily assumption of the righteous, either after death or before death, is something that's biblical. And there is no human being on earth that compares to the Theotokos, through whom God chose to become man. There's no human being in salvation history like that. You say, what about Jesus? Well, Jesus is not a human being, he's a divine being, but he has human nature. So, all right, so now, chapter 5, verse 25, chapter 5, verse 25. When Methuselah had lived 187 years, we have all these different stories. You hear about Lamech? Now, this is a different Lamech, okay? This is, some of these names are similar, and some of it has to do just with the English, not with the Hebrew, but in this case, it is. This is a different Lamech. And it says, verse 29, Lamech had a son. He called his name Noah. Noah, relief. Out of the ground which the Lord has cursed, this one shall bring us relief from our hands and from the toil of our hands. From the work of our hands and the toil of our hands. So Lamech lived after the birth of Noah, 595 years. He died. Verse 31, thus all the days of Lamech were 700. Verse 32, Noah was 500 years old. 500 years old, Noah became the father of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. All right, so mark that. Shem, Ham, and Japheth, that's a framing device. This is a great example of the history of Genesis. You don't see this stuff in a lot of the other books. Genesis is clearly, the text of Genesis comes from an oral tradition. You find these little oral tradition markers, classic devices that you find in oral stories, framing devices, chiasms, these helpers that help the person tell the story accurately every time. Okay, so here's a little frame device. Verse 3, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Noah's the father of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And now all of a sudden we get another story. And then we'll hear that line at the end of the flood story again. So just make a note of that. We'll see you later on. All right, chapter 6, 7, 8, and 9. Chapter 6, 7, 8, and 9 tell us the story of the flood. The story of the flood. When men began to multiply on the face of the ground and daughters were born to them, sons of God saw the daughters of men were fair, and they took to wife many as many they chose. What? What's going on here? Well, if you're relying upon a watchtower from a Jehovah's Witness, you probably don't know. But there's a lot of confusion over a text like this. Again, every text must be read in context. So if someone says, what is happening here? Well, daughters of men, who are they? Well, obviously you have men, you have daughters of men. These are their daughters. These are women. But who are the sons of God? Often people say, well, see, sons of God, in the book of Job, the sons of God are angels. The angels are referred to as sons of God. Therefore, these are angels having relations with human women. Okay, you'll find that in Watchtower nonsense. This is philosophically impossible. Okay, if you have any kind of any sense of basic reality, it's impossible for an angel to impregnate a human being. This is philosophically impossible. So again, this is like how Protestant eschatology develops, right? The left behind series, all that nonsense. Take the book of Revelation out of context, take the first epistle to the Thessalonians of Paul out of context, and take your pick, Matthew 24, Luke 21, one of Jesus' prophecies about the church of Jerusalem, throw all in a blender, and out comes modern Protestant eschatology, which is incredibly crazy, confusing, and very unbiblical. All right, and the same thing goes with something like this. You're taking the book of Job, take the book of Genesis, put it in a blender, and see what you get. No, read the context. We have two lines of humanity. The author has gone to a lot of work here with a lot of ink, and it wasn't cheap back then, to tell us that there were two kinds of humanity. There were those who were descendants of Adam through Cain, right? And then there were those who were the descendants of Adam, that's man, through Seth, who were said to be in the image and likeness of God. There are two lines. There's the line of man and the line of God. The line of man and the sons of men, and the line of God and the sons of God, however you want to say it. This is the whole point of chapters 4 and 5. And with that background then, the author now tells us about a problem, that the sons of God, the righteous line, begin to look to the women of the unrighteous line, the wicked line, those who are not in covenant relationship with God, and desire them, and as many as they chose. St. Ephrem, the doctor of the church, tells us this is a reference to the polygamy adopted from that line. So that now you have the line of Seth begin to look to not the women of their own line, covenantal righteous women, but rather look for the women that are outside the covenant, at the women of the line of Cain, who bring into them, with them, this idea of polygamy and murder. Which is why then we hear the rest of the story that God says, God saw, it says, then the Lord said, my spirit shall not abide in man, for his flesh, is he shall be 120 years. How long is this going to be? 120 years. Sometimes people think, well, this is how long man lives. Right, there's this divine cosmic law that the limit of a man's life is 120 years. Well, that's not what it says. When we look in this text and we look throughout the Bible, we'll find that man often lives beyond 120 years. Think of Abraham, 175. Right? There's people today. I look at the Guinness Book of World's Record today, but there's people over 120 have lived over 120. Some of them smoked up until they were 100, right? So I don't recommend that, though. So to live over 120 is not unbiblical or contrary to some cosmic law. 120 is the limit of time that man is given to repent before the flood comes. Enoch, as Jude tells us, was prophesying at the time about the people's wickedness and the coming of the flood, warning them. Noah, the prophet, warning the people. Here with a prophetic sign, as we'll see, building an ark. Telling the people what's going on. They had 120 years to prepare. And 120 years, the flood came. In fact, if you do the calculations of how long these guys lived the last couple of generations, you'll see they all die on the same day. All right, so then, chapter 6, it says, at this time, the Nephilim on the earth, Nephilim, the fallen ones, this is could be, you can take this two different ways. The fallen ones could be a reference to those who have, this is how St. Ephrem sees it, fallen off the hill of Eden. They've gone down east of Eden. As they keep going east, they go downhill. These are the ones who have gone down, right? The other way to take this is a reference to historically, if you look back, if you are an individual in the time of Moses, right, or later, and you're looking back to this ancient story, or in the oral tradition, you're looking back to this ancient primordial story, these are the ones who die, the ancient ancestors who are fallen, who have died. How? We're going to see here. It says they were violent, right? It says these were mighty men of valor, mighty men, men of renown. This is the language of a warrior from the Old Testament. Mighty men, Gaborim. Think of the mighty men of David, his mighty warriors. Right? So these are warring people. Where are they getting this stuff? You have polygamy. You have war. Well, they got this from the line of Cain. And with this, of course, comes the polytheism, paganism, of course, that they adopted. All right. In contrast to all of that, look at verse 9. These are the generations of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, blameless in his generation. Noah walked with God. Remember, he's of the line of Seth. He's the only righteous guy left of the entire line of Seth. All of the line of Seth, or Abel, however you want to call it, has now mixed in with the line of man. So that all of the descendants of Adam are all now no longer in the image and likeness of God. They're all pagans. They're no longer in relation with him, except for one man. One man from the line of Seth was righteous. And God will use that one man as a new Adam to recreate humanity. Verse 10, Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. See that little framing device? So you get a little frame there. This is you know, the story that would be told in the ancient world by the ancient Israelites. We'd be telling these stories over and over. And these are the little units. Verse 11, now the earth was corrupt in God's sight, and the earth was filled with violence, and God saw the earth was corrupt. But God said to Noah, I have determined to make an end of all things. Make an ark. And you know, it's a very big boat, by the way, three levels and all this stuff. You can figure out the dimension you want. A cubit is about a foot and a half. Verse 16, make a roof on it and decks. I will end all life on the earth. Verse 18, highlight this, but I will establish my covenant with you. And you and your sons, your wife, your sons' wives with you, and every living thing of all flesh, two by two, shall go into the ark. Verse 22, Noah did this. He did all that God commanded him, right? Framing device. He did all that God commanded him, okay? So then, that's the frame for, right, Noah was righteous, a blameless man. All right, so 2 points here. Verse 18, I will establish my covenant with you. Covenant with God means life. When you restore the relationship of a man who is dying to the source of life, the man will live. Right, so this is a fading power source plugged back into the wall or something. This is the restoration of the life it once had. Noah will live because he will be joined to God in a covenant. He will be like Adam before the fall. Covenant is not the creation of something new as much as it is the restoration of something old. Right? It's the restoration of what was before. Now, there is a newness, of course, in the new covenant, and there's a newness to each one of these things, but the most important thing to understand is it's not like just a contract, right? A man and another man decide to make a contract. This is something new. They didn't have a relationship before, and now they're making it. They're now going to have a relationship, whatever that contract says. But when you make a contract with God, when you have a covenant, when God forms a covenant with man, it is not making of something new so much as it is the restoration of what was originally planned, the original relationship that God and man had, and therefore it gives man life. And so Noah, of course, and those with him, bound in this covenant, will live. Covenants bear life. This is why the whole point of the new covenant is to give us life over death. All right, chapter 7. Chapter 7, then the Lord said to Noah, go into the ark, you and all your household, for I've seen that you are righteous before me. So here's another framing device. So you got another little unit. Take with you 7 pairs of all clean animals. So 7 pairs, I thought he said 2 pairs. Well, this is a spot where you'll hear people say, well, you see, this thing just all made up. I mean, it's all, there's stuff that's inconsistent and all that. Look, if it was made up, it would be perfectly consistent, okay? So it's the stories that are real that you find what apparent inconsistencies. It's the fictional stories, something that's fabricated that is absolutely perfect, right? So, but what's going on here? These are different units in the, that are different oral traditions that have been joined together in this written text that we have. And so one story is telling us about the fact that God, when he initially told him, he's going to bring 2 pairs of every animals. Why? Because if you have a pair, you have a pair of every animals, you're going to have life, right? The preservation of life. That's the whole point of that first unit. The second unit is trying to tell us something else. The second unit, we're going to hear 7 days, 7 years, 700, 7, over and over, 777. Why? Because Noah is being preserved during this time. It is the covenant. In Hebrew, the word for 7, sheva, is the same triliteral root for the verb to swear, as in to join in an oath, to make a covenant. Shava. And the Hebrews love to play off their triliteral roots. So wherever you have a covenantal narrative, you're going to get 7 all over the place. I'll show you other examples of this. But now, the fact that this is chapter 7, that's a coincidence. But there's a very good chapter division. All right, so chapter 7. Then Noah said, bring 7 pairs of each. Why 7 pairs of the clean animals, but only 2 pairs of the unclean? So we get a little more information. Why? Well, we're going to see at the end of the story that he's going to come out and start sacrificing the clean animals to God. Well, if you sacrifice a pair of clean animals to God, that pair of clean animals doesn't exist anymore. What are the clean animals? Sheep, goats, and oxen. Okay? Sheep, goats, oxen, a few other things. So if Noah gets out and he sacrificed the Lord a pair of sheep, well, there goes sheep for the rest of the history of salvation, creation, right? They're gone. So he's told to bring 7 of each type so that there's something to sacrifice and something from which to recreate man, right? He takes a pair of each of the clean animals and will sacrifice them to God. That leaves 6. And it was on the 6th day that God created these very animals. And so the number 6 in the Bible is a number of creation, perfection, fulfillment. And you can see this in the Genesis 1 and on. Sometimes people say, 6, I thought that was like the bad number, right? 666, the mark of the beast. Oh my goodness. Well, again, context is everything, right? You'll hear someone say, maybe 6 is a bad number because, you know, 7 is the perfect number. 6 is one less than 7. And therefore it's the number of imperfection. Well, if 7 is the perfect number, then 6 is like a B+. Okay, it's not so bad. So 1 would be the imperfect number then, right? Or 14 or something like that. The opposite doesn't make any sense. And furthermore, 7 is not the number of perfection in the Bible. This number 7 is used over and over throughout the Old Testament as the number of covenant, and in the New Testament, the number of the Gentiles. We'll talk about that in a New Testament class. So 7. So what is 6 then? Well, 6 is the number of creation. On the 6th day, God created man and said it is in the image and likeness of God and said it was very good. Okay, not very imperfect, but very good. 6 is a good number. It's the number of creation in salvation history. 6 appears all throughout salvation history as the number of creation, the number of goodness, okay? A number of examples of this. In the book of Ezekiel, look at the new temple that is described in the end of the book of Ezekiel, this vision of this new temple will be built out of Babylon exile. Everything 6s. 6 cubits this, 60 cubits that, 600 cubits this. It's all 6s. Because Ezekiel's trying to show us that this is the new creation. And of course, the vision is Ezekiel has, as the New Testament authors show us, is of the church. not of some temple building in Jerusalem, but of the temple that is the church, the temple of the living God, of which we are the living stones, as St. Peter says. Why 6:6 in Revelation chapter 13? That's a playoff of the number 666 in 1 Kings chapter 10, where Solomon has gathered 666 talents of gold and then begins his attack upon the people of God, leading them into all sorts of polytheism and other things. But anyway, that's for a study of the book of Revelation. All right, chapter 7 tells us, again, you can read on your own about all these, look at all the sevens here. God puts Noah and his family go into the ark, and then notice it says, and God, verse 16, shut him in. God is the author of the salvation, but Noah participated. Calvin. Okay, so God told Noah what to do. While the rest of humanity refused to hear the preaching of Enoch and Noah, Noah accepted, and those who were with him accepted the word of God that the flood was coming, and they decided to build an ark, and they decided to get into the ark. But it was only God that closed the door and sealed him alive, right? It was God who saved him. The salvation of mankind is, as the fathers see, a synergia, a working together of two forces, God's will and man's will, like a man and a woman on the dance floor in a beautiful dance. All right. Now, chapter 7, verse 17 goes on to tell us that everything died. It's a reversal, if you look at it, of the it's chiastic, and it's also a reversal of what we see in Genesis 1, right? The waters cover the earth, cover the dry land. And here we have just darkness. And the waters above and the waters below have collapsed, right? You have the flood, waters from below and the waters from above. Everything, a massive storm, right? If you want kind of a vision of something like this, imagine 1,000 times what you've been seeing in Texas, you know, the places. So a massive storm, all of the dry land disappears. There's nothing but water pouring down from above and shooting up from the depths of the earth. And so you have a reversal of Genesis 1, right? All is darkness. All is wet. All is dead. Except Noah. It says only Noah, verse 23, was left, and those with him in the ark. Sorry, Tim LaHaye. To be left behind in the Bible is a good thing. I hope if the rapture occurs that I'll still be in my tennis shoes. Right? Or that I'll still be driving the car. Okay? Again, that's an example of modern Protestantism's misreading of 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, Luke 21, book of Revelation, thrown into a blender. Completely contrary to the Judeo-Christian tradition. Salvation happens for man here on earth. Salvation is here on earth where man was created and where he was intended to be. And when salvation happens, God comes to man. Man doesn't go to God. So that's the story of salvation. You can see here, Noah was left behind, right? Noah was left. The rest washed away, gone, taken. So then chapter 8, and God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the cattle that were with him in the ark. What does this mean, remembered? When God remembers, we'll see this in a number of places in salvation history. When God remembers, it's not that God forgot, right? You know, he's looking, you know, there's a bunch of water and lightning bolts, and then, you know, Michael or Gabriel, excuse me, there's a boat down there. Oh, no, he didn't forget. He remembered the covenant. That reference to remembering is a direct echo of chapter 6, verse 18, I will establish my covenant, right? God remembers covenant, man forgets. This is, again, an example of how the author here is expecting, you know, the book of Deuteronomy. There's a beautiful passage in Deuteronomy 8 and 9. We hear over and over, remember and do not forget. Remember and do not forget the covenant. Remember and do not forget the covenant I made. Remember and do not forget. God remembers, man forgets, right? God keeps, man does not keep the covenant, over and over. God remembered Noah, right? He knew he was down there, and so what did he do? And God made a wind to blow over the earth, and the water subsided, right? The clouds part, the sunlight shines, and the dry land begins to appear. And Noah and those with him in the ark go forth on dry land like a new Adam with the creation following him. Okay, so the story of the flood, the resolution of the flood continues. And you can hear this new creation imagery. Look at that word wind. Wind. The word wind in the English is translating the Hebrew word ruach. Ruach. If you know Arabic, ruch, or Aramaic, rucha, this is the word that we saw back in Genesis 1, the spirit of God or wind of God, whatever you want for your translation, was moving over the waters. Sometimes you'll hear the spirit of God was hovering, some translations, but the wind of God was blowing. Either way, very nice. Helps to get the concept. What I'd like to see in all these places is the word wind in every place or the word spirit in every place. In the Greek, in the Septuagint, you get pneuma in these places. Pneuma, spirit, okay, or wind. So the wind, there was a play in the Judeo-Christian mind between wind and spirit. You can see this in the story of Nicodemus, right? The wind comes and goes, and you do not know where it comes from, where it goes. So it is those born in the spirit. The word in English, you get spirit and wind, but in the Greek text, there's pneuma, pneuma, both places. Spirit, spirit, or wind, wind. And it's playing off this broad sense of the meaning, the idea here. All right. So the point that I'd like to grasp, and anything else, is that God is recreating. The author is trying to show us this is a new creation. Saint Athanasius the Great, patriarch of Alexandria, defender of orthodoxy against the wicked Arius, said that the first thing you must grasp is this. There is no inconsistency between salvation and creation. For the same God created the world through the same word by which he saved it in the end. Right? God spoke and it came to be. Right? The word of God. This is what John tries to tell us. In the beginning was the word, the word was with God, the word was God, and through him all things were created. And the word became flesh and dwelt among us. So the same thing here in chapter 8. He's trying to show us what John is trying to show us. That salvation must be understood as creation, recreation, a restoration of what we once had. It's the theme throughout the Bible, restoration to what we once had. And in Jesus, of course, it'll be restored to even something greater. All right, so in chapters 8, we hear all these sevens again. I already mentioned that. The dove goes out and brings an olive branch. Olive branch, symbol of life in the Judeo-Christian world, right? The olive tree. And then it brings back that olive branch, a sign that the trees are now, of course, above the water level. And so now Noah knows it's time. So it waits another 7 days, and then he lets everything out. They all come out of the ark. And you get a sound just like Genesis 1 again, right? Just like we saw in Genesis 1. This is the same story. We are about the animals multiplying, be fruitful, multiply, verse 17. Then Noah and his families went out of the ark. Then God will tell them, chapter 9, verse 1, again, bad chapter vision, we bless them, so be fruitful, multiply. You even get the reference to image and likeness, just like in Genesis 1. It's in chapter 9, verse 6 and 7. You get the menu. Back then it was just the plants, the fruit. Now you can eat animals as long as they're alive, as long as they don't have their blood in them, it says. All right, so chapter 9 then goes on to tell us about the promise God makes, another covenant he makes with Noah, with humanity, that he will not destroy the earth by a massive flood. Here's a classic example of sevens. The word covenant appears, guess how many times? Seven times. How many times did you get the covenantal phrase between you and me, or between me and the Christian? Seven times. This is the author trying to show us God is creating a covenant with mankind to save them, to give them life, right? To preserve them alive, which is what the whole point of the covenants are. We'll pick up there in chapter 9, verse 18. Next time, chapter 9, verse 18, notice the framing device. The sons of Noah who went forth from the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Well, didn't we already hear that? Yeah, but again, what you're getting is these framing devices that are part of these original units. And then notice this framing device says, and Ham was the father of Canaan. That's something new that's pointing forward for the memory of the teller of the story about the next story. And that's the story of what happened with Ham and Canaan. We'll talk about that next week.